This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Berling. Coming up, a global effort begins to control persistent organic pollutants like dioxin and DDT. A report from the surface of Monterey Bay about the Oceans Conference, which just took place. A green tip on your shopping trip. And the National Guard trains its helicopter pilots by putting out forest fires and removing dead cars from a fragile ecosystem. In Kansas, farmers are combining wheat. It's part of the Great American Harvest. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Berling. On June 29, representatives from more than 100 countries, including the United States, will gather in Montreal to begin negotiating an international agreement to control persistent organic pollutants, known as POPs. The U.S. delegation will include Lynn Goldman, U.S. EPA Assistant Administrator for Prevention, Pesticides, and Toxic Substances. She describes what will be happening.
Late June, we're going to have the first negotiating session for the Global POPs Convention. And what this is, it's an international agreement to control 12 persistent organic pollutants and to establish a process for adding new persistent organic pollutants to the list that will be controlled on a global basis.
The 12 chemicals slated for elimination or phase-out include pesticides like DDT, industrial chemicals like PCBs, and byproducts from manufacturing or incineration like dioxin. Peter Orris, professor of internal medicine at Rush Medical College and director of research at the Great Lakes Center for Environmental Health at the University of Illinois School of Public Health, explains why we need to be concerned about them.
I think the problem of persistent organic pollutants is quite a serious problem. And it's a serious problem for a number of reasons, the beginning with the characteristics of these chemicals themselves. And that is, number one, they affect animals and human beings at quite low levels. Some of them disrupt the endocrine system, and others have other kinds of amplification loops in the body, so that very small amounts cause health effects. Additionally, these chemicals are persistent, as their name would indicate, in the environment, and that is that when they get into the environment, the ecosystem, they remain for quite long time, numbers of years. They're semi-volatile, so that they travel long distances, and materials that may be released in southern Mexico this week will be in the Great Lakes in a number of weeks.
When POPs drift into northern zones, cooler temperatures mean they do not evaporate. They concentrate, and this causes special problems. Again, Dr. Orris.
This ability for long-range transport and persistence in the environment causes special problems for people living in colder climates. In the Arctic region, we find that some of these chemicals are in human bodies at hundreds of times the level that they are in bodies in the United States, for instance. And that's the third thing that they do that is quite significant, and that is they bioaccumulate in the food chain. And that is that they become concentrated in the fat tissue of animals and humans and therefore concentrate as they move up the food chain.
As the negotiations begin, there's a good deal of optimism that a framework treaty can result because there seems to be some consensus between the various nations as well as environmental, industry, agricultural, and health constituencies. Jack Weinberg is the toxics campaigner for the environmental group Greenpeace.
I think that we're fortunate in that there's no force in the world that says POPs is not a problem. It's a good thing to have these poisons in everybody's body. So that's not a problem. The problem is to come up with meaningful commitments and meaningful tools to solve the problems. Many developing countries have no legal infrastructure, no technical infrastructure to address POPs or any other form of chemical pollutant. In many cases, they're going to need help, and the help that they get to put their legal frameworks in place and the technical capacity to regulate these chemicals will be welcome because it will also give them the capacity to deal with chemical pollutions in general.
Lynn Goldman from the U.S. EPA, who is also a pediatrician, says at the outset it will be necessary to communicate the degree of risk that POPs present, particularly to children, and to identify substitutes for the chemicals that should be taken out of use. She says an agreement to stop using DDT is going to be particularly difficult.
One of our biggest problems is going to be the problem of control and eradication of malaria, because DDT, which is on the initial list of 12, one of the few uses that it has in the world today that's really a legitimate use is its role in malaria control. But yet, even in that use, it is often overused. It's used in for situations where there are better and even cheaper or as cheap alternatives. And it always should be used as a part of an overall malaria eradication effort rather than in an isolated effort that just involves application of DDT. And there we have some experience in this hemisphere. We in Canada, under the NAFTA agreement, have worked with Mexico on the issue of DDT use in malaria programs, and they have succeeded in dramatically reducing the use of DDT on malaria, even while bringing the rates of malaria down very dramatically.
There is some precedent for a global agreement to reduce environmental risks. Almost a decade ago, a previous Montreal conference produced the agreement to limit the use of CFCs, or chlorofluorocarbons, which are destroying the ozone layer. Stopping POPs will be tougher. There are more of them. They leapfrog around as they volatilize into the air and come back down as rain over and over. And they come from more sources. Still, it appears that the beginnings of a solution can emerge in Montreal. The hope is to have a framework convention on POPs negotiated by the end of the year 2000. At the Ocean Conference, recently held in Monterey, California, President Clinton pledged to spend $224 million in ocean research over the next 5 years. A consortium of scientists attending the conference had asked for five times that amount, but they said the funds signify a commitment on the part of the White House toward ocean conservation. The president also signed an executive order extending a moratorium on offshore oil drilling until 2012. This bans drilling in most parts of the U.S., except Texas and Louisiana. Rachel Ann Goodman was in Monterey for the conference and prepared this report.
Nowhere is concern about the oceans greater than in the Monterey Bay. Jack O'Neill runs a dive shop and charter boat service. Today, he's giving a catamaran tour to the crush of media in town for the conference.
Well, hopefully we're going to start paying a lot more attention to our oceans. It's long overdue, and I really hope we get a lot accomplished with this and point out a lot of the problems we're having. We've got to keep the ocean alive and clean and manage our fisheries.
The Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary is the nation's largest, stretching along 350 miles of coastline from San Francisco to Hearst Castle. It's home for sea otters, whales, and hundreds of fish and bird species. But even here, toxic runoff from streets, overfishing, and kelp harvesting threaten the inhabitants. The budget for all 12 of the country's marine sanctuaries is just $12 million, 100 times smaller than that of the national parks. Werner Chabot of the Center for Marine Conservation says the time is ripe for a change.
We haven't had a conference like this or a gathering of people like this in over 30 years, and we may not get another one in another 10 to 20 to 30 years. We should be trying to change the course of history in these 2 days and then follow through on that. If we don't, we've missed a phenomenal window of opportunity, and our grandkids will look at us and say, boy, you blew it, Grandpa.
Problems discussed at the conference are immense, from the collapse of fisheries in New England to 7,000-mile dead zones off New Jersey, from radioactive waste in the Farallons to decreasing coho salmon populations in the Pacific. The oceans cover 70% of the planet, but we know more about Mars than we do about the deep. Currently, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's marine research budget is $2.2 billion, with half spent on weather prediction. That compared to NASA's $13.5 billion budget. A consortium of research organizations is pushing an ocean agenda that includes a $200 million a year increase in research spending. Efforts are underway on the state level to overhaul fisheries regulations, but fish don't respect borders. Congressman Sam Farr, who lured the conference to Monterey, says we've abused the oceans long enough.
We sort of take everything we want and can get money for out of the oceans and put back everything that we don't want, and you can't live that way where you pollute the very source of your foodstuff.
Farr is the co-author of a bill before Congress that would establish a high-level oceans commission to study threats to U.S. waters. Ocean experts say they've already identified the major problems. They simply need more money to address them. A consortium of environmental groups has been working for months to influence the conference's agenda. They sent the president a 10-point document which urges action on overfishing, pollution, and habitat destruction, and upping spending on research.
We were very afraid that this would be a major photo op and nothing else.
Vicki Nichols, director of the group Save Our Shores, helps manage marine sanctuary programs from her office at the Santa Cruz Small Craft Harbor.
So we've been working with conservation groups around the country and with our consortium here and with research institutions to try to say, don't come to California empty-handed. When you come out here, bring us something substantial. We want to see ocean changes. We want to see improvements. And that's what we're hoping to get out of this conference.
In spite of all the pre-conference jockeying for position, most observers agree the real action on ocean policy will come after the ocean conference, when the results are synthesized into a report and circulated among policymakers and ocean experts. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman in Monterey.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Our comment line is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Share your concerns with us. You can also reach us by email, green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. We all consume too much, and we're told that the best thing for the environment would be for us all to consume much less. Let's leave that for another day. Right now, let's think about the environmental impact of getting to the mall. If you figure out what you want before you get there, you won't have to go back a second time. If you take your neighbor with you, that also reduces mall trips by one. If you ask the neighbor for shopping advice while you're there, a simple trip will take so much time, you won't be able to get back. Following the speed limit on the way also helps. Your car will emit less carbon dioxide, which causes global warming, and you'll have less time to buy things when you get there. It's a law-abiding way to reduce consumption. If you can't walk or go by bike, keep your car in shape. All over the country, grease, oil, and antifreeze, which drips from our vehicles, is washed off parking lots by the rain and pollutes our waterways and groundwater. That's our green tip for this week. Many of us equate war and the instruments of war with total environmental destruction. In contrast, leaders of the National Guard see things differently. Brigadier General Bill Martin is the second in command of all the National Guard and Naval Reserves in the state of New York. Increasingly, he says the National Guard is playing a role in environmental protection. Long Island, New York is an area where he feels the Guard can play a special role.
We see the environment as a very critical part of an emerging role for the National Guard. What we're doing right now is defining that today by working with local officials down on Long Island to prepare for any emergencies that may come in the form of fires in the summer months, by training and preparing for any fire that would occur down there. So we're trying to mitigate against those kind of catastrophes and prepare for them as they evolve.
Major Mark Warnicki is senior environmental analyst for the New York State Guard. He comments on how supporting the Pine Barren Commission, which manages a huge natural area, has been mutually beneficial.
Of what we're doing down on Long Island right now is a good snapshot of where we want to go, and that's the use of our aviation assets to aid the Pine Barrens Commission in accomplishing some of the things they need to get done. And I might add in there that if we go back to what I said before, that we're here to ensure that our people can train too. We are helping the Pine Barrens Commission, doing things for the environment, and at the same time, we're allowing our aviators to train. One of the big issues I had to deal with early on was where were our 16 helicopters on Long Island going to do things like sling load training, low-level night training, which, given the density of the population down there, was a sensitive issue. And then this opportunity presented itself where we could get involved in removing abandoned vehicles from the Pine Barrens by sling loading them, where we could do low-level night observation flights for illegal dumping. And lo and behold, it was something that accomplished both a training mission for the unit that was down there, but it also tied directly into the environment. It did something in support of the Pine Barrens Commission that they needed to get done.
Colonel Frank Antenny is commander of Army Aviation Support Facility No. 1 in Long Island. There are 16 UA-60 or Black Hawk helicopters in his unit. He says environmental projects provide good training as well as support for local programs.
Well, so we've been involved in sling loading some vehicles, some derelict vehicles out there that were causing concern in the aquifer. We've been involved in sling loading reef balls for the Department of Environmental Conservation in the Great South Bay. We're involved in moving some lumber around out into the Ogdensbrook Bridge site out in Montauk for a closure of the 110-mile promenade path.
Another environmental mission performed by Colonel Antenny's helicopters is fighting forest and brush fires. The chopper is used to scoop water from a river or lake and dump it on the flames. We inspected one of the buckets that's used to haul water. It's hung underneath the helicopter on a cable and looks like a huge upside-down umbrella. The pilot hovers over a body of water and scoops up 666 gallons at a time.
This thing goes right up to the hook on the aircraft. It's about 12 feet. It's an electrical mechanism on it for the release of the dump valve. If you look inside, you can see this black pack. This black pack is a weight pack, so that when this bucket goes into the water, that weight pack, it's all shot, causes the bucket to fall on its side, causes the weight, allows the water to rush into this thing, and the bucket begins to sink. The command is giving for it to be a quick fill or a slow fill. If it's a quick fill, we rapidly increase collective application on the helicopter, cause the aircraft to rise while this bucket is still submerged. The force, the water force, forces against those straps and gives you a solid fill.
When the bucket is full, the chopper flies over the fire and dumps the load. 2.5 tons of water can be released in 2 seconds. Colonel Antenny says the monitoring of the Pine Barrens by low-level night training flights has turned up a host of insults to the natural area. These include illegal dumping by contractors, abandoned vehicles, and marijuana cultivation. The colonel says taxpayers are getting more value for their money through these environmental missions because otherwise flight training would simply consist of boring holes in the sky. In addition, the community does not oppose the low-level flying since the environmental mission has popular support. Finally, General Martin says the National Guard's work in supporting the environment is supported by the troops and is an important factor in developing esprit de corps.
As we talk to soldiers and airmen, guardsmen et al., what we're finding is that as we tell them about the emerging missions that we have under a program we're calling Guard Help, as we talk about the environment, these young people are gravitating towards that. It means something to them. They want to be involved in ways to help our environment prosper. So what we're finding is that this is something that they have a real appetite for and they're gravitating to. So we're interested in maintaining morale, maintaining a force that's vibrant. And when we talk about the environment, we're talking about what they want to talk about.
That was Brigadier General Bill Martin, Deputy Adjutant General for the State of New York, talking about the National Guard and its increasing efforts in support of the environment. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Right now, farmers are combining wheat in Kansas. It's part of the Great American Harvest. The wheat harvest is more than an agricultural process. It's part of the culture of the midsection of our nation. Harvesting begins in Oklahoma in late May and rolls northward as the wheat ripens. Much of it is done by crews of custom harvesters who travel northward with their combines and trucks from farm to farm. The wheat needs to have dried out, so it contains just the right amount of moisture at harvest time. Wheat growers have used their own personal moisture test to tell if their wheat is ready since the first plowshare was put into the Great Plains. Ed LaValle is County Extension Agent in Agriculture at the State Research Extension in Sumner County, Kansas. His farm is about halfway between Wichita and Oklahoma. He describes the coming of harvest, which he says has been in the offing since wheat was planted last September.
Around the 10th of June, why in this area in extreme southern Kansas, why we start to harvest the grain will turn from green to white or red, and then as you test it, why if you go out there and that grain crunches in your teeth as you bite it, well, you know it's pretty close to harvest.
But the harvest is more than simply cutting wheat. The crop is taken from the field to grain elevators. If the elevators are full, wheat has to be dumped on the ground until it can be moved. LaValle says the recent accident in Wichita could cause some problems in his part of Kansas.
We have local co-op elevators here, and then they ship it out to terminals. They don't have enough storage to, you know, store everything, but they, as soon as they get a big batch in, well, they start shipping out to terminals, and we just lost the terminal here in Wichita with a grain dust explosion, so I don't know, it may make it a little tight.
A big crop last year made nitrogen levels in the soil a little low this year. Southern Kansas received higher than normal levels of precipitation in recent weeks, and hailstorms damaged 25% to 30% of some fields. LaValle says test weights for bushels are running between 58 and 61 pounds. The norm is 60 pounds, which means that 1998 will produce an average yield.
Last year was probably once in 100 years we had an average yield for the whole county of 47 bushels to acre, but it's not going to be that this year. We're probably looking at low to mid-30s again. We've got some good wheat, some fair, and some poor out there, so I think we're looking at an average crop probably. And the other thing that's working on it this year is the price is about $1 a bushel lower than it was this time last year, so that's not going to help the situation either.
LaValle says the Kansas wheat harvest this year is below average in price. I remember operating a combine from Kansas to the Canadian border one summer as a college student 4 decades ago. And what I remember was not about bushels and price. It's the smell of the wheat, the prickly dust in your throat and sticking to your back, the growl of the machines, and the silhouettes of the grain elevators next to the railroad tracks on the treeless horizon, as well as the incredible beauty of those amber waves of grain stretching as far as you could see in every direction. It's the Great American Harvest, which is now taking place in the breadbasket of the world. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a new religious coalition mounts an interfaith effort to save the forests. We talk green about off-road vehicles, which may not knock down the trees, but make solitude in the forest a scarce commodity. And author William Langwisch takes us to the Sahara, where there are no trees, but the sand is burying everything, one village at a time. Stay with us. For years, environmentalists have been warning about the dangers of losing forest areas. Earth First, Rainforest Action Network, and the Wilderness Society are just a few names that you may recognize. But a new group is forming that combines faith and religion in hopes of taking forest preservation efforts to a new level. The Environment Show's Stephen Weska has more.
Jews, Catholics, Lutherans, and a few other religious groups from various parts of the U.S. are coming together to form the Religious Campaign for Forest Conservation. The Interfaith Coalition is based in Santa Rosa, California. Rabbi Stephen Pierce is with Congregation Emmanuel in San Francisco. He says a coalition member recently approached him about joining the group.
I was delighted to know that they were drawing people from the faith community together because there's been a kind of a bifurcation between people in the ecological community and the faith community. And even though we all have the same interests, for many years they did not recognize that they could work together and that they should work together. And so that's happening now, and that's very encouraging. Everyone, on both sides, both the ecological community and the faith community.
Rabbi Pierce is very familiar with the issue of preservation. He was a member of Interfaith Initiative, a group concerned with preserving the headwaters forests in Northern California. Besides private property, Rabbi Pierce says he is also concerned with logging on public lands.
The federal government, of course, owns millions and millions of acres, and very often the federal government will allow timber companies to come in at virtually no cost to clear cut trees on federal land, and that's actually a far greater problem than the 60,000 acres that we're talking about in Humboldt County, because this is with regard to the forestry of all of the national forests. So that's one issue. Another issue that we're getting involved in is the whole issue of green energy. Now that California, for example, is deregulated and we can choose our own providers, we are trying to urge people in the faith community to select electric companies that have at least 50% renewable energy in their power supply.
Rabbi Pierce says the destruction of forest areas is contributing to global warming and causing the decline of species across the globe. Owen Owens agrees. He is with the American Baptists Board of National Ministries near Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and a member of the coalition. Owens claims that only about 2% of the forests located on North America 500 years ago exist today.
The old growth forests are being cut down. Every year, about an area about the size of the state of Washington is completely cut. And this is very serious because it changes the climate. One of the things I found out about where I live is really interesting. And that is that the groundwater, which we all depend on for drinking water, doesn't recharge during the summertime because all the trees transpire so much moisture that it just basically keeps things in balance. And that moisture, which goes up, is the basis of the clouds and the thunder and the rain. In countries where all the trees were cut, like in Palestine, maybe a couple thousand years ago, or in Greece during the classic period of the Greek philosophers, the climate was radically changed.
As to why a large-scale interfaith coalition wasn't created sooner to address environmental issues, Owens believes most religious groups tend to work within themselves. He says the religious community usually comes together when there's an issue that threatens everyone. But Fred Krueger sees it differently. He is a founder of the Religious Campaign for Forest Conservation and a member of the Christian Society of the Green Cross, an environmental Christian group in California. Krueger believes the Age of Enlightenment and industrialism pushed the notion of being stewards of the land out of traditional religions. Meantime, while the campaign is just getting started, Krueger believes it will help change modern attitudes toward forest areas.
The churches are a sleeping giant on environmental issues. That as we begin to recover our moral voice on this area, that an ethic of the land will emerge that will allow a balance to be restored between human society and the planet's ecosystem in a way that we haven't had. And so the mercantile mentality has run roughshod over the land in a way that is degrading the quality of life. And it's unacceptable from a religious perspective, and it's going to end.
Krueger says the goal of the Religious Campaign for Forest Conservation is to help religious organizations articulate what's happening to such areas while educating legislators and others about forest care. Members of the campaign will meet in mid-July to draft theological statements which will lay out the group's objectives. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Controversies have been brewing all over the country for years about motorized off-road vehicles. I'm talking about snowmobiles, jet skis, motorized dirt bikes, and other vehicles simply known as ORVs. And for some, they're a great source of outdoor recreation. They get people back into places that they might not get to otherwise. And for others, they're the scourge of the earth and the sea. It's charged that they create air pollution, they cause erosion, they make noise, they scare wildlife, and they are alleged by many to make life miserable for hikers and others who enjoy the solitude of the outdoors. And so recently, two environmental groups, the Friends of the Earth and the Wildland Center for Preventing Roads, has issued a report entitled Tales of Destruction. And it documents destruction of public lands by ORVs, and it calls for a moratorium on further trail construction. So we're interested in your views. Should the use of ORVs be limited, and should trail construction be stopped? Let us know what you think. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. I have two very knowledgeable guests today. Gawain Kripke, he's the Director of Economic Programs at the Friends of the Earth. That's an environmental organization, which is one of the publishers of the report. He's in Washington. And also with me is Clark Collins, and he's Executive Director of the Blue Ribbon Coalition. This is an off-road vehicle users advocacy group, and he joins us from Idaho. So, Gawain, let's start with you. As an environmentalist and one of the folk responsible for this report, why do you think there ought to be a moratorium on trail construction for ORVs?
We believe there ought to be a moratorium on trail construction for motorized off-road vehicles for a variety of reasons. The first and foremost is because more needs to be known about the impact of off-road vehicles on natural areas before we move ahead with greatly expanding their usage on public lands in our national parks and wild areas. Secondly, the agencies that administer these public lands have enormous backlogs of maintenance already on the trails that they have. And before we go constructing new trails, we need to start maintaining the ones we have better, because that's where a lot of the environmental and ecological problems happen, is when you have trails that aren't well maintained.
So, Clark Collins from the Blue Ribbon Coalition, the charges that are made, particularly in the report, relate to environmental damage, which it's alleged that the ORVs make. How do your members react to that?
Well, for one thing, off-highway vehicles is the term that we like to use, off-highway vehicles as opposed to off-road vehicles, because then that includes the four-wheel drive vehicles that are a large part of our membership base. Well, one of the things that I'd like to address is the charge that because of a maintenance backlog that there should be a moratorium on new trail construction. Well, for one thing, there's very little new trail construction going on to start with.
Now, just before we get into that, we're talking about new trails on public lands. Is that the issue here?
Right.
Okay.
And there's actually very little being done with regard to new trail construction on public lands. What we're basically involved in and in what we've helped to address through state and federal legislation is the maintenance concern, trail maintenance concern, and mostly what we're attempting to do is to maintain our access to the existing trails that we've been using all these years. And in fact, you know, I'd like to point out for your listeners that when we first started pushing for national legislation to address this concern that has been just recently reauthorized as the Recreational Trails Program, that I met with Brock Evans with the Audubon Society, who I know you know very well, Peter, as former president of the Audubon Society. And the Audubon Society was supportive of that concept when we first initiated our effort to get that legislation passed back in 1989. And in fact, the Audubon Society, to my knowledge, never has aggressively opposed the Recreational Trails Program the National Recreational Trails Program.
Let's go back a moment. We'll come back to trails, but I suppose one of the arguments for making sure you have trails is that if these vehicles are kept on trails, then they'll not do a lot of damage elsewhere. One of the things that I read in Gawain's report is that, aside from the trail issue, there's just tremendous amounts of destruction that's occurring because people are riding these things around on fragile dune areas and wetlands that are otherwise getting chewed up. And Gawain, is that in itself, from your perspective, a reason for further limitation on the use of these vehicles?
Well, absolutely. It's a deep concern that the use of these vehicles on public lands, and especially in fragile areas, is having an impact on the environment. And some of the most popular areas for off-road vehicle use are the most sensitive to that kind of intrusion. We're talking about very delicate, arid ecosystems that where you can trample a desert area, and it won't recover for decades or ever. Wetlands are equally sensitive, and there's a lot of sensitivities out there that we think need to be studied more and carefully regulated before we move ahead. And one of the main problems we're facing is that the agencies that administer our public lands are profoundly underfunded, and they do not have the staff to adequately enforce restrictions on off-road vehicle use or even other kinds of use like backpackers. And certainly they don't have the resources to maintain the trails and do proper assessments of whether it's appropriate for that kind of use on those lands.
So, Clark Collins, do you see environmental damage in public lands caused by ORVs as an issue that your organization needs to think about?
All uses of public lands have impacts. And, in fact, the Friends of the Earth representative indicated that, you know, mentioned that other users have impacts as well. We feel that all user impacts need to be considered fairly. And, in fact, what we're talking about here is impacts on trails and the amount of land that's impacted.
Well, but let me stop you there. That presumes that the ORV user stays on the trail. Isn't part of the problem that in some public areas, they're all over the place?
I was going to give you an example of an area that has been managed for off-highway vehicle recreation for about 25 years, the Turkey Bay ORV area in southern Kentucky. That area has an OHV area that has been managed as totally open, enabling ORVs or off-highway vehicles, whatever you want to call them, to go wherever they want. Now, since that area was established as an OHV area in 1973, the impacts on the ground in that area, the percent of the ORV area receiving impact is 3.5%. So 3.5% of a totally open area has been impacted by that use.
Now, is that small amount because people stay on trails or because they don't go there? Or
it's because they primarily limit their impacts to trails, but there are a lot of other areas that are desert areas where the percentage of impact would be about the same. And plain and simple, we all have impacts on the environment, and our user community and our organization in particular has led the effort to provide funding to the land management agencies to help address those concerns.
Okay, let me get a judgment from both of you. Given the existing management efforts in public lands, is it adequate to deal with the problems that ORV presents, or do we need to do more, either restriction, enforcement, or whatever, to protect resources that are otherwise being damaged? Going, where do you come out on that?
Absolutely not adequate. The agencies, the federal government agencies that are supposed to manage and these lands in a stewardship for the American people, just don't have the resources. And I want to make if I may. Well, just
before we get to that, let's hear from Clark Collins on that issue as well, on the question of whether we're adequately protecting public lands now.
Well, I want to point something out. We support strict enforcement of reasonable regulations.
Are there places that need to be regulated now that are not regulated?
There are places where there is inadequate enforcement, and then the answer from anti-recreation access groups, such as Friends for the Animals or Friends of the Earth, is further restrictions, more regulations, and instead of addressing the problem and helping to provide funding to address these concerns.
That's not true at all.
Their answer is just eliminate that use entirely.
We've advocated aggressively for increased enforcement monies. I think there's two questions. One is whether it's proper enforcement of off-road vehicle activities, where it occurs and where it's appropriate. And then there's a separate question about whether it's appropriate in other areas. There are many areas where off-road vehicle activity just isn't appropriate. It's too sensitive. They're wilderness areas where there shouldn't be this kind of activity going on. It's supposed to be preserved in some kind of
wilderness areas prohibit motorized access.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there is motorized access going on in some wilderness areas. Illegally.
We would support strict enforcement of those areas. You know,
Let me ask you both a somewhat parallel question. There are uses outside on trails. I happen to be a cross-country skier, for example, which are not compatible with the snowmobiler, since it's not a lot of fun to have a snowmobile crawl up your back when you're skiing. How do we sort out who gets what in terms of places in public lands? How do we make this allocation between the motorized user and everybody else? What is the position, Clark, of your organization about that? Should there be places that are not, that are recreational areas in which ORVs stay out of, and how do you figure that one out?
There are areas, and they're called wilderness, and as I mentioned earlier, we support strict enforcement of those wilderness boundaries.
Let's take something that's not wilderness. Let's take an easily accessible public land or park or whatever.
Well, I want to give you an example of a local trail system that I'm very familiar with, because here's our position. Recreation interests need to learn to get along. They need to learn to share. And our organization attempts to build rapport between the different recreation interest groups so that they can learn to share.
Okay.
So that they can help make decisions on trail allocation.
Our time is limited going. Is this sharing taking place as you see it?
Well, I think recreation interests need to learn to share. I agree with that. Unfortunately, what seems to be happening at the federal level is that a preponderance of resources, in the recreation trails program that Clark mentioned earlier, are going towards motorized use. And while motorized users represent a fraction of the overall users of public lands, somewhere between, say, 5% and 15%, they're getting up to 70% of the trail funding.
Too big a piece of the pie.
Too big a piece of pie.
Clark
of
Collins,
pie, exactly.
How do you feel about that? Your guys getting too much?
For one thing, we are not getting 70% of the funding from that program. Now, there's the potential for motorized users to get up to 70%, but we're not.
That's what I said.
And 30% of that fund is dedicated entirely to non-motorized trail projects, and the fund is supported entirely by fuel tax revenue that is paid by off-highway vehicle enthusiasts. And in fact, it's only a portion of the fuel taxes collected by off-highway vehicle enthusiasts. There's been estimates that over $200 million a year in fuel taxes are paid by off-highway vehicle enthusiasts.
I'm afraid we're running out of time.
$30 million will go to trail.
I'm afraid we're running out of time. The question of fuel raises a whole other issue about air pollution and whether we shouldn't mandate the four-stroke engine, but we simply don't have time to deal with that. Perhaps we can come back to it another day. We've been talking about off-road vehicles and their impact on the environment. My guests have been Gawain Kripke from the environmental group The Friends of the Earth and Clark Collins from the off-road vehicle users advocacy group Blue Ribbon Coalition. This is an issue which inspires passion on all sides, so share your passion with us at 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can hear The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. Go to our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. Or tell us what you think by email. It's green@wamc.org. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author William Langwish, it's the Sahara Desert in Algeria on the African continent. In this portrait of place, Langwish reads from his book titled Sahara Unveiled, A Journey Across the Desert.
I stayed on in El Wed and in the early hours walked south along a crumbling paved road under assault from the sand sea. The morning was bright and hot, and the dunes carved crisp lines against the sky. I passed a turbaned man on a donkey carrying empty gas cans into town. There was no other traffic. The minarets of El Wed disappeared behind me. The road led eventually to a village, or what was left of it. It was a village that had been mostly buried in drifting sand. The corners and roofs of stone structures still showed, but only three houses remained inhabitable, and from the evidence of digging around them, they too were threatened. I drank at a well with a rope and a bucket. There was no farming here. The only sign of industry was a freestanding stone oven, a baker's oven, against which palm wood had been stacked. The wind blew sand, but otherwise nothing stirred. Two men sat in the shadow of a wall by a fire, on which they had placed a blackened pot. They motioned me over and offered me tea in a dirty glass. The men were older than I, bearded and thin, and had no work. We spent a few hours together. They pointed to where the school lay buried and to where most of the village stood beneath the sands. I asked them the details of its burial. They said, "The sands are fickle. Dunes may drift for decades in one direction or not drift at all, then suddenly turn and consume you. Consumption by the sand is like other forms of terminal illness. It starts so gently that at first you don't worry. One day the sands begin to accumulate against your walls. You've seen the sand before and naturally assume that a change in the wind will carry it away. But this time the wind does not change and the illness persists. Over weeks or longer, the sand grows. You fight back with a shovel and manage to keep your walls clear. Fighting back feels good and gives you something to do. But the grains never let up, and one morning while shoveling, you realize that the dunes have moved closer. You enlist your sons and brothers. But eventually, the land around your house swells with sand, and you begin standing on sand to shovel sand. Finally, no amount of digging will clear your walls. The dunes tower above you and send sand sheets cascading down their advancing slip faces. You have to gather your belongings and flee. But your house is your heritage, and you would like somehow to preserve it. As the dunes bear down on it, they will collapse the walls. The defense is again the Saharan acceptance of destiny. Having lost the fight against the sand, you must now invite it in. Sleeping on the sand, covering your floors with it for all these years, helped prepare you mentally. But shoveling in the sand is not enough. Your last act is to break out the windows, take off the doors, and knock holes in the roof. You allow the wind to work for you. If it succeeds and fills your house, the walls will stand. Then in 100 years, when the wind requires it, the dunes will drift on and uncover the village. Your descendants will bless God and his prophet. They will not care that you were thin and poor and had no work. They will remember you as a man at peace with his world. The desert takes away, but also delivers."
That was author William Langwish reading from his book, Sahara Unveiled, A Journey Across the Desert. It's published by Vintage Books. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If you're out camping and the National Guard drops water on your campfire from a helicopter, listen to the show again. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and order show number 442. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.